In his annual almanac, published in the year 1739, the founding father of the U.S., Benjamin Franklin, wrote the following: "Friends and neighbors, the government taxes indeed are very heavy, but we are taxed twice as much by our idleness, three times as much by our pride, four times as much by our folly, and from these taxes, the commissioners cannot deliver us. However, let us hearken to good advice, and something may be done for us. God helps them that helps themselves." So, our idleness, our pride, and our folly cost us more than we realize. They certainly cost us more than our taxes, which we so dread. And the government can't help us much with that. They can cut our taxes, but they can do very little about our laziness, our arrogance, and our foolishness. For that, we need to follow good advice. For God helps those who help themselves. But does He? Don't get me wrong, we need to take responsibility for our duties. When we ask the Lord for help, but we aren't prepared to do our duties before Him, we shouldn't be surprised if the help is not coming. It's absolutely true that some things God will do for us, but He will not do it without us. In fact, it is only as we trust Him while carrying out our responsibilities that He enables us to carry them out. But then it's equally true that for other things, God helps those who cannot help themselves. Listen to Romans chapter 5, verse 6. "For while we were still helpless, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly." So the saying, "God helps those who help themselves," doesn't hold for everything. It's true that when God instructs us in His Word about specific duties, but it's not true when we need to trust God alone to save us, and listen to this, to fulfill His purposes in us. If we rest in Him for those matters, He helps us and He blesses us more than we can ever imagine. In our message this morning, we see how Sarai, Abram's wife, failed to do that. Instead of waiting on the Lord to fulfill His promises, or even seeking Him to clarify His will, she rushed ahead of herself, of Him, and helped herself. And in the end, she wasn't helped at all. In fact, she made everything worse for herself and for her family. But then, her helpless handmaid, Hagar, was helped enormously and blessed wonderfully by the Lord. And this was an exceedingly bitter pill for Sarai to swallow and a very expensive lesson to learn. Let's get into Genesis 16 and learn what we must learn about receiving God's help and God's blessing. Now, Genesis 16 starts with a note about Abram's wife Sarai, about her circumstances. In verse 1, we read, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar." In Genesis 15, just the previous chapter, the Lord told Abram in no uncertain terms that he will have his own son as heir. And then He took him out to the night sky and He told him to count the stars, which of course he couldn't, to make the point that there will be as many descendants as he would have, innumerable. And then God sealed that promise and His relationship with Abram with a covenant. And so God committed Himself to Abram and to His promises in the strongest possible way. What did Abram make of it? Well, he believed God. He actually took what God said to be true, and he trusted God, even though it was physically and biologically impossible for them to bear children. He believed that they would. Why? Because God said so. What remarkable faith Abram had, and what a remarkable promise God gave him. We move on one chapter, Genesis 16. And what? He and Sarai had still had nothing. There wasn't even a bun in the oven. That is to say, she wasn't even pregnant. No sign of it. And the time was ticking. So Sarai felt the pressure. Perhaps she felt that she was the problem. And she needed to come up with a solution. So Sarai had an idea. You see, she had a maidservant called Hagar. Now, in the ancient world, well-to-do people had slaves who carried out their duties for their mistresses or their masters. And sometimes slave girls or maidservants were given to a bride as a bridal gift. It's quite possible that when they were in Egypt and Pharaoh had his eye on Sarai and he gave her a wedding gift or the marriage dowry, that included in the package was this servant girl. Or perhaps she just purchased this lady along the way. Whatever the case might be, this servant lady, Hagar, was Sarai's property. And she had complete control over her. The text makes it quite clear. What then was Sarai's scheme? Look at Genesis chapter 16, verse 2 to 4. And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant. It may be that she shall obtain children, that I shall obtain children by her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. So after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her servant, and gave it to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt upon her mistress. Notice that Sarai attributed the main reason for her barrenness to the Lord. And she was right. The Lord had closed her womb. He did the same thing with Rebekah, Isaac's wife. The same thing with Rachel, Jacob's wife. And the Bible teaches us that children are a gift from the Lord. And for reasons best known to him, he can choose to grant the gift or to withhold it. And as painful as the providence might be today, it was worse back then. We spoke about the calamity of childlessness last time, but we didn't mention how painful it was for women. There was a social stigma to that. If women couldn't have children, people would think there was something wrong with her. Perhaps she was cursed. And when polygamy was practiced, the husband could just take another wife and solve the problem. And that would leave the wife with a double heartbreak. So, the best option Sarai could see was to give her handmaid, Hagar, to Abram as a wife. Normally, that's what the father of the bride would do. But she owned Hagar, and so she did it. Now, before we object, this was an acceptable practice during the time of the patriarchs. We see the same thing happening with Rachel and Leah, remember? Jacob's two wives. They gave their servant ladies to Jacob to bear children for them through him. This is what we call surrogate motherhood. In those days, it was a way to overcome childlessness. Of course, only accessible to the very rich. Today, with medical advances, people use things like artificial insemination and IVF, in vitro fertilization. Now, it's not our purpose to look at all of the options and which ones are right before the Lord. Our point simply is that Sarai decided to make use of surrogate motherhood, which gave her the option of legally having a child. Custom allowed for it. It seems that Genesis is fine with it. And notice that Abram had no objection. He happily agreed to the scheme. So he married Hagar, and within no time, there was a baby on the way. The plan seemed to work like a charm. Or was it a bomb? Sarai's scheme worked like a bomb. As soon as Hagar saw she was pregnant, suddenly her attitude towards her mistress changed. She thought much less of her and much more of herself. After all, she was carrying God's man Abram's child. And for all they knew, he was carrying the promised seed. So she despised Sarai. However, there are hints that Sarai's plan was a big mistake. Firstly, notice that the way that this account is written parallels the fall in Genesis 3. Let's have a look. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 6, Eve took the forbidden fruit, ate it, gave it to her husband, and he ate. In Genesis 16, verse 3, we read, Sarai took Hagar, her servant, and gave it to her husband as a wife, and he took her. In Genesis chapter 3, the woman was the main actor, and her husband just played along. The same happens in Genesis 16. Secondly, Sarai's plan, even though it was allowed in those days, it still went against God's original plan for marriage as the union between one man and one woman. And thirdly, it seriously affected the family harmony. We've already mentioned how it soured her relationship with Sarai, or Sarai's relationship with her maidservant. But that was just the beginning. Listen to Genesis chapter 15, Genesis 16, verse 5 and 6. And Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your servant is in your power. Do with her as you please." Then Sarai dealt very harshly with her, and she fled from her. Sarai got very frustrated with how everything turned out, which, by the way, was quite predictable. But then she went on and she blamed Abram for the whole mess when it was her idea in the first place. Sarai got so upset that she called judgment on her husband. "May the Lord judge between you and me." And then Abram gave a rather weak response, as if he had no part to play in this. To pacify his angry wife, he suggested that she take her frustration out on her servant, who, mind you, was by now his own wife carrying his own child. So Sarai didn't hold back. She dealt harshly with Hagar. The word "dealing harshly" here is the same word we saw in the previous chapter in Genesis 15 when God described to Abram what will happen to his descendants in Egypt when the Egyptians get hold of them and make slaves out of them. And this caused the pregnant Hagar to flee back to Egypt. So, the whole scheme ended with a disaster for everyone concerned. Hagar lost her home, Sarai lost her maidservant, and Abram lost his second wife and his child. This is a very important lesson in this for us. And the lesson is this. It is possible for us to convince ourselves that we're doing the right thing when in fact we are running ahead of God's will for us. This is what Sarai was doing. She tried to help herself when she should have waited on God to help her. In His time and in His way. Or at least she should have sought Him to clarify His will for her before she took such drastic action. Now, of course, Sarai could have justified her action by looking at the custom, everyone is doing it, or just relying on reason. It just makes sense. But did she act in faith? Based on the revealed will of God. Did she? What do you say? We've noted the parallel between her actions and Eve's with the fall. But notice that when she went to Abram and she told that God was responsible for her barrenness, she was right, but she was also wrong. She was wrong in blaming God. And that is exactly what Satan did when he came to Eve, blaming God for withholding fruit from her. And it is when the challenge, those thoughts are unchallenged, that the forbidden fruit becomes irresistible. And so Sarai didn't challenge her own thoughts, and so her own scheme became irresistible. And so she allowed her desire to take over and to control her, just as Eve did. Secondly, God actually had a wonderful plan in store for Sarai. This becomes clear in just the next chapter. Listen to what God says to Abram in Genesis 17, verse 15 and 16. As for Sarai, your wife, you shall call her name not Sarai, but Sarah. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall become nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her. Sarai was part and parcel of God's covenant plan with Abram. She was going to bear him a son. And not just any son. The son that would ultimately carry the promised seed of the Messiah. So God's plan wasn't just to bless all nations through Abram, but to bless all nations through Abram and Sarah. The irony or pity was that if Sarah had just been a little bit more patient, God's good and perfect will for her would have become abundantly clear to her. Nevertheless, there was already enough revelation that should have caused her to put a pause on her scheme. In Genesis 15, verse 4, God said to Abram, "You will have a son from your own body." What does Abram need for that? A wife. Who was his wife? Sarai. There was no need for her to find a replacement for herself. If God could do it for Abram, He could do it for her. She was 10 years younger than him. She had a bit of a better chance than him. And since Abram didn't ask for it, why did she offer it? That should have been a warning signal to her. But why did Abram not shoot down her bad idea? Perhaps that speaks to the persuasiveness of the ladies and the weakness of the men. And what a lesson that is for us men. Sometimes we give in to our wives' desires, and then both of us fall into a pit. Anyway, so was Sarai's plan God's plan? No. She didn't act on God's revealed will for her. God didn't give her the faintest idea that was what she had to do. But she still did it. Dear friends, whenever we are tempted to do something, especially when we do something that could have big consequences, we'd better make sure that what we are about to embark on does not violate any of God's clearly revealed will in the Word. Now, let me just mention one area. There are so many, and I'm sure you can think of many. But let's go to the area of marriage. Many professing Christians choose to marry unbelievers. Many. They convince themselves that the circumstances brought them together. And since they really, really want to get married, and this is a very nice person, is God's will for them. And besides, what better context can you find to bring the unbeliever to the Lord than by marrying to the person? Now, is that true? Singles who desire to get married, what do you say? And you who have your eye on that beautiful unbeliever, what do you think? Who doesn't submit to Christ's Lordship? Is it as rosy as you imagine? Now, if you're wondering, then go search out a Christian who has been married to an unbeliever for 10, 20, 40, 50 years. Go ask them. The best marriages have challenges. But for a Christian to marry an unbeliever is a different ball game. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 verse 14 graphically depicts it as being unequally yoked. And the picture here is of two animals, say an ox and a donkey, pulling a plow together with different strengths and different natures. Apart from the fact that you're not going to get a straight furrow or a neat furrow, the one animal will overburden the other one or injure the other one. And that is why 2 Corinthians chapter 6 verse 14 expressly forbids Christians to marry non-Christians. Is that clear? So you young adults who love the Lord, don't even think about starting a relationship with a non-believer. Don't even think about it. And when someone comes and sweeps you along, off your feet, make very sure that that person is a true Christian. It doesn't take a couple of conversations to know that. It takes time to see the true colors of a person and their true character. We need to move on. We have seen how Sarai tried to help herself, and it was disastrous. Now we'll see how God helps the helpless Hagar. Now, remember, Sarai treated her so harshly that she ran away. Genesis 16, verse 7 tells us that she went along the route from Canaan to Egypt. Now, imagine the pregnant lady running through the desert all alone, utterly vulnerable, exhausted no doubt, and finally reaching a spring to regain strength. And there, something extraordinary happened. What? The angel of the Lord found her. This is the first explicit reference to an angel in the Bible. But notice, it doesn't refer to an angel, but to the angel of the Lord. Four times, actually. And there's very good reason to believe that the angel of the Lord here was not a normal angel. He was the Lord Himself who appeared in a human form. Notice the clues. In verse 9, He says to Hagar, I will surely multiply your offspring. He's referring to himself as the one who will do what only the Lord can do. And then listen to Hagar's testimony in verse 13. So she called on the name of the Lord who spoke to her. You are a God of seeing. For she said, truly, I have seen him who looks after me. What we have here, dear friends, is what I believe to be a Christophany. So, children, do you know what a Christophany is? A Christophany is an appearance of Jesus in the Old Testament before he became an actual man. Now, we'll see the pre-incarnate Christ again in Genesis 18, when together with two other angels, he meets Abram. And then he has a conversation with Abram, telling Abram that you're going to have a child. Your wife is going to have a child, while Sarai was listening in. In Genesis chapter 22, we'll see the angel of the Lord again stopping Abram from sacrificing his own son. And there are many other references to the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament. Now, why did the angel of the Lord appear to Hagar? What did he say to her? Basically, three things. In verse 8 and 9, he said, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? She said, I am fleeing from my mistress. Then the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit to her. Of course, he knew exactly where she was coming from and where she was going. She was the one who didn't know where she was going. And so he called her to account, and he made her think, you belong to Sarai, and you're bearing Abram's child. Running away from problems was not the solution. It almost never is. Are you running away from your problems instead of facing your problems with God's help? Anyway, the right thing for Hagar was to humble herself, go back to her mistress and submit to her. And that's exactly what she got commanded to do. The second thing that the angel of the Lord told her is in verse 10. I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude. Going back as God commanded her wouldn't be easy. The path of obedience often seems the hardest. But with the promises of God, we can walk that path with courage and confidence. And what a promise God gave her. The promise of innumerous descendants secured her future. And if her future was secured, she had hope for the present. By the way, this promise sounds a lot like the one God made to Abram in Genesis 15, verse 5. So much so that it makes one wonder, was God not going to fulfill these promises through Hagar after all? That brings us to the third point that makes clear that he wasn't. In verse 11 and 12, the Lord said to her, that the baby that she was carrying was a boy. And she must call his name Ishmael, which means God hears. Beautiful name. Because God listened to her in her affliction. God is very kind. He's very caring. He hears our cries when we sincerely call upon him. And when he hears our cries, it is code word to say, help is on its way. Back to Hagar's son Ishmael, the Lord added that he will be as a wild donkey. Wild donkeys are rough. roam around independently, unruly and ready to fight. Similarly, the legacy of Ishmael would be fierce independence and violence, even against his own relatives. It didn't take Ishmael long to start to show his colors. In Genesis chapter 21, verse 9, when Isaac was just a small boy, his older brother Ishmael started to pick on him and make fun of him. And Galatians chapter 4, verse 29 interprets this. And it says that Ishmael persecuted Isaac. And so Ishmael became a type of those who persecute true believers. Nevertheless, the Lord met helpless Hagar at a greatest point of need. He called her by name and he showed her wonderful kindness. In his kindness and care, he commanded her about what to do, and he gave her a promise to hold on to. How did she respond to this amazing encounter with the Lord? In Genesis chapter 16, verse 13 and 14, we read, "So she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, 'You are God of seeing.' For she said, 'Truly I have seen him who looks after me.' Therefore, the well was called Beer Lahai Roy." It lies between Kadesh and Bered. As Hagar saw the angel of the Lord, she realized that she saw Yahweh himself. And she called his name El Roy. El Roy, which means God who sees me. Even in the wilderness, God had his eye on her and he was looking after her. And then to commemorate God's care, she named the well Beer Lahai Roy, which means the well of the living one who cares for me. Beautiful, strengthened in the spirit, she returned home, gave birth to a son, called him Ishmael, as the Lord had commanded her. What have we seen this morning? We've seen the two women in Abram's life in action in Genesis 16. Abram's dear wife Sarai tried to help herself instead of calling on and trusting in the Lord for help. And her self-help scheme backfired terribly. And then we saw Hagar, Sarai's handmaid, getting caught up in Sarai's flawed scheme. But in his kindness, the Lord found her in her helplessness, blessed her, and gave her a future. 2,000 years later, Mary, the Lord's handmaid, had a similar encounter with him and got a similar message. "Behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. He will be great and he will be called the Son of the Most High. And the Lord will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." Dear friends, Jesus' birth wasn't the product of a human scheme, a flawed human scheme, but of God's perfect salvation plan. He is the Son of the Most High and the promised seed, born in the line of Abram and David. And he came into this world as the eternal King to help us in our helplessness against our sinfulness. Do you know your own helplessness and your need to live under this King to help you? If you do, then Romans chapter 5, verse 6 to 9 is good news for you. "For while we were still helpless, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for a good man someone would dare to die. But God demonstrated his own love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Much more then, having been justified by His blood, we shall be saved from God's wrath through Him. It is when we come to Jesus in our helplessness and trust Him for our salvation, our protection, and our direction, it is then that we will be helped. He helps us against our sinfulness, our laziness, our arrogance, our foolishness, and whatever other vice or adversary or difficulty we may face. Jesus helps those who trust Him in their helplessness. Let's learn to do that. Let's trust Him for everything. And God will bless us, and He will fulfill His promises in and through us. Amen.